You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is the 14th of October 2016 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Just before I introduce my two co-hosts for today, I've just got a couple of announcements that I'd like to make. Tomorrow we're going to have a live simulcast with Forum Anglorum that will have Millennial Woes, Project England Rising, Adam T. Wallace and the Duke of Durham, and that will, we're hoping to be about 3 hours long, but that will be starting at 10 p.m. British time, 5 p.m. Eastern, and that will be a live simulcast, so check that out tomorrow. I also wanted to say thanks to Moshe Shekelrod, who's been doing the images for us on Monday to Wednesday. I want to say thanks to Angel, who's done us up some new album art. Ben Garland, who's fixed the podcast feed for us. And if people weren't aware, Ben Garland from endofzion.com, he manages the podcast feed. He uploads all our podcasts to that archive, makes sure that they get delivered to your devices. And he also schedules all our articles at the Daily Stormer. So there's a lot of people that work behind the scenes for Radio Aryan, not just the hosts that you hear. And also Andy Greatstory over at YouTube, who uploads all of our podcasts to his YouTube account. And you can also find lots of other radio on there as well. He's got TRS on there, David Duke, Stormfront, all sorts of stuff on Andy's channel. It's a great channel. I do recommend people check it out. I always check it out over the weekend to try and find some new radio for myself to listen to. So that's got the announcements out of the way. As always today, I'm joined by Mr. Dennis Wise, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, and Messerschmitt with his Schmitt's Axis War Heroes series. So, Dennis, how are you doing today?
Doing all right, thank you. I hope everybody out there is doing just as well. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it should be a good show. We're going to be having part five of Hans Joachim Marseille. We've got a new story about Ursula Haverback after that. And we've also got some questions and comments if we can fit them in. But as always, we're going to start off with Schmitt's Axis War Hero. So, Schmitt, how are you doing today? And would you like to give us a quick rundown of where we got to with the story with Hans Joachim Marseille?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm not too fond of the cold weather, but yeah, I'm doing all right.
Particularly cold where you are as well.
Well, it's not that cold where I am. I'm not up in the mountain, so. But I like winter weather around Christmas, but otherwise I'm better served with warm and sunny weather.
No snow yet where you are then?
No. It would be unusual. But it's rather cool for this time of year and very little sunshine.
We've had a glorious month, one of the best Octobers I can remember. Really, just glorious sunshine all month. It's been absolutely perfect end to the summer and sort of beginning of the autumn. Couldn't ask for better, Schmitt. And also couldn't ask for better with what's going on with Donald Trump as well and then Brexit this summer. It's been a fantastic year all round, but I don't really want to take this too off topic. And we've got lots to try and fit in tonight. So, let's get on with Hans Joachim Marseille.
Yes, very well. So in part four, I talked about his amazing aerial combat maneuvers, his masterful deflection shooting, and we discussed the effects of high G-forces on the pilots. By the way, I tried to find out about long-term effects of G-forces, but I couldn't find anything. I did find a post on a pilot's forum where a woman was concerned about her father having a medical condition, perhaps because of these long-term effects, but the pilots there didn't know anything about any kind of research into the long-term effects. So we just don't know at this point. I also recounted the time he nearly got lost in a sandstorm with his airplane, and finally the rather long quote of what happened when he was finally able to put his theories into practice and break up these defensive circles. And now the fifth and final part. On November the 3rd, 1941, Marseille received the Ehrenpokal für besondere Leistung im Luftkrieg, the honorary cup for special achievements in the air war. This was awarded to pilots or other air crew who had already earned the Iron Cross First Class but had not yet merited the Knight's Cross. The cup was a creation of Hermann Göring, even though in World War I a similar cup was already awarded to German pilots. Göring was among them, one of the recipients. From that point on, Göring wanted to be informed about Marseille's deeds, just like he later wanted to be updated on everything Erich Hartmann did at the Eastern Front. Already on December the 1st, Marseille received yet another highly esteemed decoration, the German Cross in Gold. This award was given for 6 actions, which would each of them merit the Iron Cross First Class. In the meantime, after the failure of Operation Battle Axe, the British had shipped to North Africa 300 more Crusader tanks, 300 M3 Stuart tanks, 170 Matilda tanks, 600 field guns, 240 anti-aircraft guns, 200 anti-tank guns, and 900 mortars, aside from other supplies. They were to be used in the next British offensive called Operation Crusader. On the other side, Rommel had received the 90th Leichte Afrika Division instead of the Panzer Division he had requested. So instead of the Panzer, he had received an infantry division. The reason for this was most likely that all Panzer were needed at the Eastern Front. By the way, here we can revisit a question that came up during the Skorzeny presentation. The 90th was known for the time as Division zur besonderen Verfügung Afrika, just like Skorzeny's men had this designation, zur besonderen Verfügung, for special disposal, which means that this unit could be sent wherever it was needed most. It would be at the disposal of the officer who requested it, and this designation has nothing to do with disposing of someone or something. So, when Operation Crusader started towards the end of 1941, roughly 1,000 British tanks, 100,000 men, and 1,000 aircraft were to attack the Germans and Italians. The numbers given vary wildly from source to source, which I find remarkable. It's almost like certain people who call themselves historians throw dice to determine historical numbers. David Irving has in the past commented about these so-called historians. According to him, they usually copy from each other without doing original research on their own. For example, Wikipedia says the British lost 800 tanks, while World War II database says they lost 278. But as the operations on the ground are not the main subject of this series, I'm not going to spend too much time on Operation Crusader. But here's some details I found remarkable. At Bir el Gubi, the Italians fought an amazingly brave defensive action. On a hilltop, the 1st and 2nd Battalion of the Giovanni Fascisti, the Young Fascists, Infantry Division, beat back the attacking British tanks and Indian infantrymen. As one British historian, John Gook, writes, although Nuri had an overwhelming superiority in every arm in the area of Bir Gubi, the failure to concentrate them and coordinate the actions of all arms in detail had allowed one Italian battalion group to frustrate the action of his whole corps and inflicted heavy casualties on one brigade. End quote. And elsewhere, the same historian, the GGFF, that is the Young Fascists, made their mark during Operation Crusader. Tasked to defend the small hill known as Bir el Gobi, they fought off repeated attacks by the 11th Indian Brigade and British 7th Armored Division during the first week of December 1941. Despite overwhelming odds, they inflicted massive casualties on the Allies and held their ground despite severe hunger and thirst. End quote. Panzerkampfgruppe Stefan faced the British 4th Armored Brigade and pushed them back, knocking out 23 Stuart tanks while losing only 3 of their own. On the second day, an element of Panzer Regiment 8 under Major Fensky ran into elements of the 4th Armored Brigade and supply trucks of the 8th Hussars. which were positioned in a defensive hedgehog formation. A few minutes later, Fensky reported to his regiment commander. One brigadier general, 17 officers and 150 men captured. 35 tanks, a number of guns, and several communications vans confiscated. End quote. And Fensky received the Knight's Cross for this action. Now, as to the outcome of Operation Crusader, the sources again vary extremely in their assessments. World War II database calls it an overwhelming success for the British, while Wikipedia calls it a limited success. Personally, I would say it was a stalemate, but a moral victory for the Africa Corps, considering they were so outnumbered in war materials and supplies. Nevertheless, the Germans and Italians had suffered a lot of casualties in men. As I mentioned before, Wikipedia states that the Allies lost 800 tanks, and they state that the Germans and Italians lost 340 tanks. Because of the bad supply situation, the German ground crews did some incredible improvising work on the damaged airplanes. They patched up holes in vertical stabilizers with cloth and a sewing machine, for example. Marseille remarked on their efforts, "Our ground crews have earned special praise, but even their magic has its limits if they can't get any more spare parts." End quote. By December 24th, the situation for Marseille's Geschwader was really bleak. All three groups together were able to only master 6 planes fit for combat. Fuel was in extremely short supply, and during the retreat westward, a lot of the ground crew had been killed or taken prisoner. So on that day, 6 109s hurled themselves against 20 Hurricanes, who had again formed a defensive circle. Marseille was on sick leave in Athens during these days. If he had been there, the following situation would most likely have been avoided. Erbo, Graf von Kageneck, Graf means count, he was German nobility, tried to do what only Marseille could, enter the defensive circle and break it up. He was almost immediately hit by 2 or 3 opponents and heavily wounded. He managed to fly back to base and land safely. He was immediately treated and, as soon as possible, airlifted to a hospital in Naples, where he, victor in 67 air engagements, succumbed to his wounds. Marseille burned with desire to return to his comrades because, incredibly, Rommel was planning to go on the attack again. But it was not to be, as he received a telegram with very bad news from home. "Your sister is dead. Please come home to Berlin." His sister had been very close to him, and in Berlin he learned that she had been slain by someone who claimed to be in love with her and apparently killed her out of jealousy. Marseille was stricken with grief and from then on was not the same anymore. He kept smiling and joking, but somehow his comrades could see that he was merely forcing himself to appear cheerful.
Yeah, that would be a real shock, I would have thought, hearing that happen. I mean, that you don't really expect to hear that in amongst white people, to hear someone being slain like that. You often hear of Negroes doing it, you know, slaying their white girlfriend out of jealousy like that, but that's pretty rare to happen among white people. It's good to hear that he attracted Goering's attention at last, and I found... You know, we were discussing this last time about all the problems they would have had with trying to find spare parts and making stuff up for the aeroplanes. But to think that they were patching up holes with bits of cloth, you know, it really got this bad for them. I mean, they were in quite a serious bad way with their equipment, as well as heavily outnumbered. But yet still, they fought on. These boys had real valour, didn't they? You know, they were quite amazing courage to do what they did and to continue doing it. And you can see there that there's no wish to get off and go and have some time in hospital. They just want to leave the hospital straight away or get back off leave and get straight back in the cockpit and start fighting again. You know, they must have really, really must have made them feel alive, being up there in the air and fighting for their nation and knowing that so much was riding on them, I think. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make before Schmidt continues?
Yeah, actually, it was nice to hear that the Italians actually put up a bit of a fight, because you never hear anything of the sort in any of the World War II documentaries. And the old fascists, obviously, themselves are great valour. So it's really nice to know, because Italians did take a lot of stick, I believe.
Definitely. Schmidt, would you like to respond to that, or do you want to continue with the presentation?
To what you said, yes, it's incredible that they had this high morale. And I think in Africa, Marseille had a lot to do with it. He was the hero of the soldiers, no doubt about that. And sickness, yes, it was not that uncommon. I mean, the Germans were not used to the climate at all, as you can imagine. And the food and the water was not always the best. So it was not totally uncommon for pilots to fall ill. But as you said, it seems to be a common theme among these pilots that even when Hitler personally tells them to be grounded, to not go to war again, because they had already achieved that much and had earned their rest, they would just not be told not to go back to the front and be with their comrades. I think they would have felt terrible knowing that their comrades were dying and they would be having a sort of cushy job at home.
Definitely. I mean, it's a Jewish way of thinking, isn't it? Let the others take the risk, and I'll do everything that I can to get away from it. I think that's what Hitler was saying. That's what caused the stab in the back was the Jewish types and the pacifist types doing all they could to get away from being at the front. And then once they were back at home, they were starting up strikes in the factories and stopping the people from producing the ammunition and damaging the war effort and promoting the idea that they shouldn't be fighting at all, that sort of thing. Once they actually got into the hospitals and they got home, they were causing all this trouble. And it was the people that didn't have the balls to go up to the front and fight in the first place.
Yeah. And the Italians, I was also quite surprised to read about that. But I guess they were ideologically sound and knew what they were fighting for, these young fascists. So, where was I? Oh, yeah. On top of his whole misery, he also learned how many of his comrades and friends had fallen during his absence. Still, he did not neglect his duty, and on the 8th of February 1942, an incident happened, which I mentioned before. Marseille was about to land at the Martuba airfield after having escorted a German reconnaissance plane. Suddenly, he heard the following warning over the radio, and I'm going to quote from the biography now. 7 Curtis behind you, echoed in Marseille's ears. Thinking quickly, he retracted his landing gear back into its wells and pushed his plane down until he was racing along just a few meters above the ground. He made a left turn and, catching the enemy fully by surprise, pulled sharply upward into a steep climb. In the blink of an eye, the Bf 109 had climbed up and well past the startled enemy. From his perch, Marseille pounced on the confused enemy. While the ground personnel stared transfixed at the scene unfolding before them, Marseille first ignited the enemy plane flying to the right with a single burst of cannon and machine gun fire. Turning to the right, he knocked down yet another opponent. Flight Sergeant Hargreaves, the pilot of the first plane to be shot down, bellied his plane in and was taken prisoner by the Germans. The following is an eyewitness account of the engagement as seen from the ground. The sirens began wailing as the 7 fighters were seen approaching the airfield. Hauptmann Neumann rushed to the radio shack and, just before entering, turned around once more only to see a lone Bf 109 coming in for a landing with its gear extended. It was Marseille's Yel-14 on final approach. Marseille had not yet seen the attacking enemy, who were approaching in a lateral staggered formation with the sun at their backs. When the lead aircraft was still approximately 200 meters behind Marseille's plane, the pilot pushed the stick down slightly so that the nose of his Curtiss dropped and pointed directly at Marseille's BF-109. Seconds later, his gun spat fire. The first tracers just brushed past Marseille's canopy. Marseille put his plane into a lazy turn to the right, causing the Curtiss to overshoot. Then the man, staring into the sky, watched as Marseille yanked back on the joystick and pointed his nose to the heavens. At the same time, landing flaps and gear disappeared into their recesses. The mouth of his guns coughed forth a fusillade of lead, and seconds later, the British plane was wrapped in flames. The stricken Curtiss hit the earth near the perimeter of the airfield. Yellow 14 was already passing at low level over the drifting column of smoke and dust, then disappeared shortly afterward on the horizon. Edu Neumann continued to stare at the remaining Curtiss planes when Marseille reappeared, pulling up sharply from a low altitude and firing on another Curtiss onto which he had brought his sights to bear. The cannon rounds knifed through the left wing root, severing it from the fuselage. Marseille banked at an altitude that was becoming lower and lower. Three of the British fighters attacked simultaneously. Already traveling at a dangerously slow speed and low altitude, Marseille whipped his plane around on a reciprocal course right in front of his enemy's noses. This maneuver nearly caused him to stall out, but Marseille, the aerobat, was able to use it to achieve a decisive advantage over his foes, who were forced to make a significantly wider banking turn. His plane suddenly picked up speed. The BF-109 made a whistling sound as it raced over the airfield, passing directly over Neumann's command trailer before turning into a third Curtiss. With a short burst from all guns, the enemy plane dove straight into the ground and exploded into a massive fireball, scattering its debris over a wide area. Hauptmann Neumann had stormed into the command post. He tore the receiver from its mount. First Staffel answered on the other end. "Are you asleep?" bellowed Neumann. "How long is Marseille expected to go it alone up there?" "They're already in their planes," responded the duty officer on the other end. Neumann tossed the receiver back into its cradle and rushed back out into the open. Four Curtiss planes were still in the fight. From different directions, they fell upon Marseille's plane. At this moment, three BF-109s from the first Staffel roared down the field. Marseille saw them as well. "It's about time you showed up, you bastards," he called. Turning his plane, he dove at a right angle to the aircraft, taking off until he was just a few meters off the ground. Three aircraft were still on his tail, the fourth having broken off. Marseille was in his element. He pulled his craft up into a steep climb, made a tight chandelle, and dropped once again toward the airfield, pulling up a hair's breadth from the runway. Then he raced towards the sky again, flipped his BF-109 onto its back, did a half-twist, and continued the fight. The four Curtiss planes broke sharply away, and in light of the three Messerschmitts, now on their way to the rescue, fled the scene. A short time afterward, Marseille came into view once more. Landing gear and flaps had already been extended. With the engine slowly turning over, the airplane set down for a landing. All the men, including the commandeur, ran over to where Yellow 14 had come to rest. Covered in sweat, Edu Neumann reached the plane only to be greeted by the smiling, albeit stressed and haggard face of his apprentice, Marseille. The ground crewman pulled the pilot out of the cockpit after releasing the parachute harness. They carried him up to the Gruppenkommandeur and sat him on his feet directly in front of Neumann. Marseille reported back from a combat mission. Neumann embraced the young flyer and clopped him on his sweat-stained back. Words were not appropriate following this dramatic duel over the airfield, a duel which everyone had experienced from front row seats. End quote. And on the 1st of September, all the available German fighters in Africa were in the air. 35 BF-109s. Marseille was with a new wingman, Oberleutnant Schlang, and again, it was Marseille who first spotted the enemy. He counted a total of 16 planes. At 9 o'clock 26 minutes, he was in attack position. He jumped an enemy fighter from below and behind, pulling up into a steep climb and firing from close quarters. All his wingmen could do was observe and note the air victory. Marseille immediately fell upon a second enemy plane, which exploded at 9 o'clock 28 minutes, 2 minutes later. A Spitfire then tried to come at the yellow 14 from below. Marseille spotted it immediately and dropped steeply downward, firing as he passed by. This enemy as well fell burning into the desert below. This went on and on, until after 3 sorties on that day, Marseille had defeated 17 opponents, 8 of those within 10 minutes. Afterwards, Italian pilots gave Marseille a car on which was painted Otto, which is the word for 8 in Italian. And during this month of September, Marseille scored 54 air victories. But at the end of the same month, on the 30th, Marseille was flying a combat patrol with his comrades. As they found no opposition, there was no fighting, but the engine of Marseille's new BF-109 G2 started to develop troubles and the cockpit was filling with smoke. He couldn't see anymore, but his comrades guided him to the German lines. When they had reached them, Marseille told them that he had to abandon the plane. He rolled his plane onto its back and climbed out. But the airplane had started to enter a dive, and so when he jumped out of the cockpit, he was hit by the vertical stabilizer. To the horror of his friends and comrades, the parachute did not open. All they could do was helplessly watch as Marseille fell to the earth. He was most likely instantly killed or knocked unconscious when he was hit. Either that or he died instantly when he hit the ground. The whole Afrika Corps, but especially the pilots, fell into a deep depression. But they never forgot him, and Italian engineers erected a pyramid in his honor. It decayed over time, but in 1989, Eduard Neumann and other survivors of Jagdgeschwader 27, in cooperation with the Egyptian government, erected a new pyramid, which stands to this day. On his grave, which is in Tobruk, there is a one-word epitaph: undefeated.
Wow. That's a bit like they felt a bit down when it happened. I feel a bit down hearing about it now, Schmidt. What a tragic end. What an absolutely tragic end. I hope the memorial still stands in Tobruk and the Libyan terrorists haven't damaged it in any way, because that's right in the middle of Libya is Tobruk. I mean, that's so tragic. What a tragic way to go. And I was thinking he was going to make it when you said he said this to his friends, but he must have said that on the radio, the last words that he said to them before he jumped out and that happened to him. That's so sad.
Yes, right. It was over the radio.
Yeah, that's really sad. But what an amazing life. And he had a good last month of it, didn't he? 54, did you say, he took out in that last month?
That's right. It was 54.
Yeah. Amazing. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
I just thought, what a great epitaph. One word. When he said it's going to be one word, I thought, what's that going to be? An undefeated. Well, what a cracking episode.
Yeah.
Truly remarkable guy, got to be honest.
Definitely. They all are. And I do like the way that you narrate them, Schmidt. You certainly add a bit of gravitas to it, a bit of emotion to it and drama when you're describing the dogfights. You know, I can see it in my mind's eye, what's going on. Yeah, it's I think that was your best one yet. So thank you very much for that. Well, thank you for doing them. I know the listeners appreciate them. You know, I get people send me tweets saying they appreciate them, and I know you don't have Twitter, but we see the comments in YouTube and elsewhere. I know people like them, and yeah, do you want to let people know what you're working on at the moment? How far you've got up to with it?
Well, I'm working on the Degrel presentations, putting them into one piece and adding video footage. And I already did about half an hour, but I may have to redo a lot of it because we weren't quite happy with the audio, and you were so kind as to work over the audio. And so it may take a bit longer than expected, but I hope people will like the end product.
Well, it looked really good what I've seen of it so far. I mean, the footage that you put with it, it fits with it really well. I think it's going to be a well-liked series, and I think it's going to go down very well with the listeners. It's very good what I've seen of it so far. Anyway, Dennis, have you got anything else you'd like to comment on that before we move on to the next discussion we're going to have?
No, just to say, as you said, I think he's doing a great job. I mean, we spoke during the week about a little bit of advice about him making these picturesque documentaries, as you like. And he did a great job for his first attempt, and I told him so. And I would have told him, you know, if it weren't. So, you know, that I'm not hiding anything. He would really have been proud of that first piece of work.
Yeah, we'll definitely be honest with you, Schmidt. You know that. Okay.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to have it any other way.
Yeah, well, that's
and I'm, of course, very glad about any input from Dennis concerning videos. It's like learning from the master. So I'm very pleased about that.
Please.
Honesty is the best policy.
Anytime.
Credit where credit's due. And there should be a lot of credit to this next piece that I just want to let people know about. And this is Ursula Haverback, who listeners are probably aware of. If they're not, she's a 86-year-old German lady who has tirelessly campaigned for truth in history over the years. She did a panorama interview for British television. She wrote a letter to a Jewish organization saying, look, you know, there's all this evidence to show that not so many of your people died after all. And they were only in labor camps. Your relatives weren't gassed to death in a hideous, terrible tragedy. A lot of them actually came out of it alive. And there's evidence to show that. So this very brave, courageous German lady has been trying to get the truth out about the Holocaust, and she's been taken to court three times now, and they've pronounced the sentence, a prison sentence on her at 86 years old. And the most recent pictures of her talking about this show her really happy for some reason, and people were sort of wondering, why is it that she's so happy? Well, I've had a message from Richard Edmonds, veteran British nationalist, and he says that the reason why she's so happy is that this is all part of her plan, because every time that they jail her, she appeals the jail sentence. So she hasn't actually been put in prison yet. So she appeals the jail sentence, and each time that happens, it gets taken to a higher court, and she's hoping to get it right up there to the highest court in the land. And I'm guessing that that probably means that if it's in the highest court of the land, it will no longer be in front of a magistrate. It will have she will have a jury there, and then she will be able to present her evidence, which is the most important thing, because we know that the German laws are different to the laws elsewhere. We know that in Canada they've stopped evidence being shown to the courts to do with the Holocaust. If you get charged with Holocaust denial after the Ernst Zundel trial, where the witnesses were shown to be unreliable, and even though Ernst Zundel was found guilty, his lawyer, Doug Christie, totally destroyed all the witnesses, and all his evidence shows that the Holocaust didn't happen. But they ended up finding him guilty anyway for no reason really, other than to please the Jews. But since then, they stopped people being able to do that. And in Germany, they even say that a lawyer that defends Holocaust deniers, if they defend them, then they're denying the Holocaust themselves. So if she actually gets this right up there to the top court, then she will be free to defend herself, take the witness stand and defend herself. And I'm guessing that that's what she's wanting to do. And this, you know, this brings up two things, really. I mean, this is very brave of her and courageous of her. And it's terrible the way that this one point of history we're not allowed to investigate and we're not allowed to discuss. But it also brings up the point of our jury system. I mean, we in Britain, we had Magna Carta in about the 12th century, which said that nobody could just give you summary justice. Nobody could just give you a fine or anything like that. You always had to be judged by your peers. You always had to be judged by 12 people. And back then it was 12 of your friends, so that they could speak up for you and say, well, no, he wouldn't behave like that. Or, you know, if this happened, then he would have had a good reason for it. So you always should be judged by 12 of your people. And that was supposed to prevent any tyranny like we have now from ever occurring, because there would always be 12 people there that you could appeal to. So, of course, they've done away with juries now, pretty much in most cases. And we just have summary justice. We just have magistrates that hand out fines for speeding and all sorts. But if we'd have kept with a jury system, then none of that should really have been able to happen, because they would have taken you into court and said, well, you were driving too fast. And you could have said, well, you know, I'm not a reckless driver. These people will stand up for me. And that isn't a crime anyway, is it? Nobody's been hurt. Nobody's been injured. Nothing's been stolen. And, you know, the jury themselves, the 12 people themselves would have said, well, look, this is just trying to make money for the court. You know, nobody's going to deliberately put themselves in any danger. So having the jury system, having these 12 people there, should have prevented this tyranny that we have now from happening. But it hasn't, and they've overdone the Magna Carta. They want to change our Bill of Rights here in Britain. And obviously in Germany, it's even worse. It's all summary justice apart from the main court. So hopefully Ursula Haverback will keep appealing until she gets to the main court, and then she will have her day in court, and the world will know that she was right. I really can't see that. Well, they may try to put her in prison at 86 years old, but that would cause an absolute scandal. And by the time it gets to that stage, it will be in all the international papers that this woman is in court. And I'm getting this story from the Daily Express in Britain. And looking at the comments section, 9 out of 10 of the comments are supporting us. They are saying it's wrong to criminalise people for their opinion. There are far worse genocides that have happened than the Holocaust. There are a few in there that are obviously know like we do that it didn't actually happen. And there's all the evidence shows that it didn't happen. But the majority of them are just normal people that can see that it's completely wrong to be jailing somebody for having a different opinion to the prevailing one. And that's the important thing, because that shows that if we can get this out to the people, to everyone, to your average liberal or lefty, that people are being locked up. An 86-year-old woman is being locked up for having a different opinion on the evidence of what happened 70 years ago, then they cannot help but be on our side. Now, we are promoted as these, you know, these really nasty people, but if we could just get this truth out, I think, you know, a lot of them might have a change of heart when they realise that this is a free speech issue. It's not a hating anybody issue. It's a free speech issue. And the Jews themselves should be really, really pleased and happy to know that their ancestors didn't die by being tortured to death in a gas chamber. You know, they should be really cheerful about that. So again, this highlights the fact that there's more to it than that. And that they must know that it's a lie themselves. Otherwise, they wouldn't be trying to prevent the investigation of it. They would be really happy about it and be saying, well, that's really good. You know, that's really good that our ancestors weren't tortured to death. Because anybody else would be happy to know their ancestors didn't die like that. Wouldn't you, Dennis? Wouldn't you be happy to know that your ancestors weren't tortured to death?
I don't think the thought of losing all that Holocaust pension would bear well with them if they decided that there were no such thing. An incredible brave woman, by the way. I was looking up some things before we came on air about the system in Germany. Now, how why this goes up, like you said, you know, maybe in a higher court it's different. I have a feeling it won't be. But you can't really mount any kind of a defence, you know, to say I'm right. The only plea you can do is, unbelievably, by the way, is I am wrong, have mercy on me, or I'm insane, put me in an asylum, but don't put me in prison, whereas be lenient. Them's the only two pleas you can actually put in a Holocaust denial court, which probably surprised a lot of people, because a lot of people on the outside who don't realise the situation, when they hear somebody's being jailed, they probably think, oh, it's been proven. Truth is no defence. And this is, this comes, I think, from the ADL from way back. So you've just got to bite the bullet and accept the court's verdict, which will be guilty. Over the years, we've also known some of the lawyers of these Holocaust deniers have also been imprisoned. And also there was a scientist who was sent over to Auschwitz to run some tests because somebody had proven that there were blue staining on the walls, and he went over there and he came back and he actually said he agreed all his findings. He put an honest bit of work in and said, you know, he agreed with the original findings, and he got put in prison for just an honest day's bit of work.
All the science is there, isn't it? And all the scientific investigations have been done. Yeah. The walls have been tested for cyanide. You know, there's not one autopsy report of anyone that was ever gassed. There couldn't have actually been any gas chambers there because the actual rooms themselves aren't sealed. We've got the Red Cross reports. I mean, all the evidence is there. I know that Bishop Williamson, when they tried to do him for a Holocaust denial, he kept appealing it. And I think eventually they dropped it, because this has got to be the way of doing it. You keep appealing it until you get to the highest court, and then the witness themselves must be allowed to give evidence. If the lawyer gives evidence, then the lawyer is going to be arrested, as you say, because they'll say that either they're mad or they're actually denying the Holocaust themselves. But if the witness himself has been accused of it, already been accused of it, that they have to give the witness a say. If they don't give the witness a say, they don't allow the witness to present their side of the case, then Germany is going to look very bad indeed, even worse than Germany does look already for arresting 86-year-old women for questioning the events of 70 years ago. I mean, this really is at the level of a religion, isn't it? It's heresy that she's been charged with.
I can remember in the past, people have tried to bring it to the fore so they can have a debate about it, and they've been point blank refused by the Jews on the point that it happened, and that's the end of it. There's no argument, you know, as far as they're concerned, it happened, and there is no argument. Which is, it's the only event in history which is protected by law. I mean, you know, and you can think of how many events there are throughout history. It's just, you know, what have you got to hide by protecting it with the law? Well, after the Canadian court case of Zundel, when the Canadians actually slipped up by having that court case, they thought it's going to be a straight run, but Zundel pulled in some pretty impressive witnesses and had a great lawyer, Doug Christie, as you said. And in the first trial, it was so devastating to the witnesses and the survivors that to be found out that the books they'd written had now got to be changed. And many didn't even bother turning up for the second trial, as they just didn't want to know. But obviously, you know, Holocaust trial to be won in a Zionist-run country, such as Canada or Britain or anywhere else. I mean, David Irving, as we found out, didn't have any luck. I mean, you're never going to actually win a Holocaust court case, I don't believe, no matter how much evidence you present. They're just not going to have it. They'll put it to one side and they'll charge you guilty.
And so brave, these revisionist historians. They really are such brave, courageous people. Think of the age of this lady that's doing this. Now, I'd really recommend that people get Michael Hoffman's book, hold of his book if you can, The Great Holocaust Trial. And he goes into detail of everything that happened in the Ernst Zundel trial, because there are a lot of news reports that only came out once and then were never seen again, never heard of again. And he's got all the press cuttings in that. He tells you what was in the news reports that disappeared. And it really is an eye-opener. It was really seen as a triumph, even though Ernst Zundel was found guilty, I think, of promoting false news. The trial itself was a fantastic triumph for revisionism. So that's called The Great Holocaust Trial by Michael Hoffman. Dennis, I believe you've got some comments and questions that you wanted to address.
Just a couple of questions from a guy, Randolph Fuller. He wanted to, a couple of questions answering. He says, I know the Jews fought for the Third Reich. I would like to know how many, and what was it that made them fight for Germany and not flee the country? And how could the Germans distinguish the good from the bad Jew? According to a Jew himself who wrote the book, and his family actually disowned him after he wrote the book, about the transfer agreement, he disclosed that 150,000 Jews fought for Adolf Hitler and the German Reich in World War II. I put in a documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told, because I, for one, haven't heard about the transfer agreement, and I'm quite sure a lot of other people haven't as well. And this kind of exposed how Germany was cooperating to get rid of the Jews, not by just kicking them out without a suitcase, without a shirt on the back, but by transferring the money down to Israel. Once they got to Israel, then they had a special bank set up, and they would send the money. If they couldn't take belongings with them, they could sell them and then pass the money on. And it killed the whole myth. But it also started a new myth by saying that Adolf Hitler created Israel because he worked with the Zionists. And he did work with the Zionists, but obviously they were the only ones who took the Jews. Nobody else wanted them. And it was a peaceful way of getting them out there. So 150,000 fought for Germany and won quite a few medals as well, I must say. And he said, how come, what made them fight and how come they didn't flee the country? Well, you know, they probably felt German. I don't think these were practicing Jews. I think they probably had Jewish blood in them from third or fourth generation. But they decided they were German. They were happy with the culture in Germany and wanted to defend it from communism and fight alongside the National Socialists, which is credit to them. How could the Germans distinguish good from bad? I don't think you can distinguish good from bad. It just goes off actions and you just take it as you find it. But certainly if somebody wanted to fight for Germany, then they signed up. And, like I said, many won medals. So that's the best answer I can give.
Well, I think the best way that we can, you know, to solve that problem of which ones are the good ones and which ones are the bad ones is if you have an ethno-state and you keep that ethno-state pure, then it doesn't matter if they're part Jewish or they're part Negro or they're part Chinese. They all don't belong in the state, and they can't actually be citizens. But if they behave themselves well, then they can be classed as subjects. If they're useful to the state, to the ethno-state, they could be there as subjects, but not to have any actual say in the goings-on of the state. There was a law, the Catholic law, Sic et Judaeus non. You weren't allowed to attack the Jew, but the Jew wasn't allowed to subvert the state. The Jew wasn't allowed to engage in usury. The Jew wasn't allowed to demoralize and try to put temptations in front of the Christians to bring them down to the same level as the Jew. He wasn't allowed to do any of that. But by this, by the same token, we weren't allowed to just attack the Jew for being a Jew, which is basically saying, you know, the Christians were the citizens and the Jew was just a guest. That's all he was. But it wouldn't really matter whether he was a Jew or what he was. If the blood wasn't pure, then you can't say that you're a German. You know, all you could say really is that they're a bastard. They're a mulatto, a Mongol sort of thing. It's the same with British. It's a lie to say that a Pakistani is British. British means looks like Brutus. So only anyone white looks like Brutus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the World Cup when you saw France come out, there were more black-skinned French than there were white. But just to go back onto this thing about being German and being Jewish, Emil Morris is his driver, and he was one of the first people to set up the SS, was found to be Jewish. But Hitler wouldn't have it any other way. I mean, you know, the guy worked for him. And he declared him, you know, an honorary Jew, which I also mentioned in the documentary. So there were some rules, definitely, that made it life easier for these people who were high up in the National Socialist movements who were found to be of Jewish blood, but were still considered to be German.
There's always exceptions to the rule, isn't there? And the National Socialists built that in to their ideology, because if there was an exception to the rule like Emil, then Hitler at the very top, with his Führer's prerogative, could make an exception to the rule. But only the guy right at the very top could do that. And that was because he knew him, and he knew his character. He knew that he wasn't going to be a traitor.
What people have to remember is that most Jews at that time in Germany were communists, or vice versa. Most communists in them days were Jews. And so when Judea declared war on Germany, when Hitler came to power in 1933, they immediately became an enemy of the state. It wasn't anything that Hitler did to throw him into prison, apart from being a communist. But when Judea, international Jewry, declared war with the sanctions on Germany, then he couldn't allow Jews, just like in America when, you know, a war with Japan, all the Japanese were put into camps, and likewise the Jews were put into camps, because obviously they were now classed as enemy of the state. And even the Jews in Germany weren't happy with the situation, because they knew that, you know, they were going to be at the brunt end of it.
Yeah, the Jews of the rest of the world dropped the German Jews right in it. Yeah, they wrote about this. They wrote letters about it. There's a book that Simon Shepherd publishes over at Heretical Press, heretical.com, that was written by a Jew in National Socialist Germany. And he was loyal to them, and he said the place was fantastic, and the Jews weren't persecuted, really. It was the communists who were persecuted. And just to go back to where you were talking about the Havara agreement, where the Jews went out to Palestine. At the time, Palestine was under British control. It wasn't a sovereign state for the Jews to do whatever they wanted. The Jews could go over there, but they were under the control of the British state. And Britain was responsible for the Arabs and for the Jews over there. And the terrible thing is that Britain withdrew and just left the Jews to do whatever they wanted to the Arabs. And the Jews also committed terrorist acts against the British that were over there, that were the police and the British army. It blew up a hotel, horrific torture to death of British army personnel. And it's all covered up now. It's all hidden. And they don't allow, you know, a memorial isn't said for them, for these brave British soldiers that were killed by these Jewish terrorists. That, you know, it's part of the London Forum Group have started holding a memorial once a year for them.
It's the same as for the US Liberty as well. You know, that's another thing. You know, that's been covered up. I mean, I was talking to a guy not long back, and he thought it was a conspiracy theory. That's how well they've covered it up.
Well, this one, they don't have a wreath that's laid on the Memorial Sunday. I forget the name of it, but British Heroes, Forgotten British Heroes campaign. That's it. And they go and lay this memorial. They advertise it in the big newspapers, and the leftists won't go and protest it, because they know that if they do, they will be drawing attention to the fact that these Jewish terrorists attacked British servicemen just after the war, right after we had fought the war. Terrorist acts against the British people. So when Hitler was sending these Jews over there to Palestine, it wasn't like he was sending them over there to this new state of their own. He was sending them over there to be under the control of the British people, to obey the British laws, and for the British people to be responsible for them. So it doesn't contradict what he said in Mein Kampf about if you give the Jews your own place, they'll just turn it into a center for their criminal operations, because it was supposed to be under the same laws that Britain had. It wasn't supposed to be under Talmudic law. That was the difference. That didn't happen until after the war. Did you have another comment, question, Dennis?
Well, it's not so much a question. This is something that I saw during the week, and I made a comment about it on my Facebook page. I noticed a couple of days ago on the headlines on Sky TV where they had a... It's been slowly building up, but they had a young child who was apparently injured, covered in blood. But instead of running him off to hospital, they had him actually talking for five or 6 minutes, saying how evil this Assad was. It was just pure propaganda. We've seen it before. And you could sense, my instincts could sense that this is a build-up of something. And then immediately after that piece of news finished, Sky came back on saying that they had a poll that people had been asked whether British troops should go into Syria to save these children, save the Syrian people, just like we heard save the Iraqi people, just like we heard save the Libyan people. And there's a little bit of a build-up going on here now, and especially with the Trump and Clinton election, where you've got every time now Trump come, for instance, he won the debate on Sunday, without a doubt, but immediately women came out the following day claiming sexual harassment. And I believe that this is a campaign now, the timing of all these things, what are coming out from decades ago, are specifically aimed at the audience that Trump needs. He's looking for these people who haven't decided yet, mainly women, who certainly aren't going to vote for somebody if they're going to keep coming out saying that he's a sexual predator. But this is a campaign which is, I think, calculated to get Clinton in. Now, Clinton's already spoke. The media didn't pick it up when they did the debate on Sunday. She's still asking for a fly zone. Well, if she's going to have a fly zone at some stage to enforce that fly zone, which will be illegal anyway, they're going to have to bomb either Syrian airfields or shoot down Syrian aeroplanes. So Putin is not going to sit back and let that happen. And so consequently, if she follows through on a rhetoric, then I'm afraid the world is going to be in a hell of a dangerous place.
Well, hopefully she is not going to get a chance to carry any of that through. I'm sickened by the emotional blackmail myself, Dennis, seeing the way they put those kids on there. They don't ever show you any of the kids that on the other side of Aleppo that are getting bombed and blown up by the terrorists, and they don't ever remind people. Yeah, they don't even remind people that a terrorist is anyone who commits violence to achieve a political aim that isn't the state, which is exactly what these Muslims over there in Syria are. Anyway, we've come to the end of the podcast. We covered that a bit in some other podcasts this week anyway, but it's good to get that in at the end there. So I'll just say thank you very much for coming on once again, Dennis. Thank you very much, Messerschmitt, for coming on once again. You can find Dennis on YouTube, Twitter, and now Facebook. And don't forget to tune into Radio Aryan again tomorrow, 10 p.m. British time, 5 p.m. New York time, for a Forum Anglorum simulcast. And we'll be back here, same time, same place, next week on Radio Aryan. Have a great weekend.